Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand, Brian Lin, and Katie Weaver. Later, we will present the next part in our series on America's national parks. But first, here is Susan Shand.
For most of the last 100 years, Europe's royalty have been known for little more than grand weddings and newspaper gossip. Now, that might be changing. Spain's King Felipe VI used his power to denounce Catalonian separatism. He called the leaders of the 2017 independence referendum criminals and said it was his constitutional duty to save national unity. And now the British media is wondering if Queen Elizabeth II will be called upon to end the coming constitutional crisis over Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plans to take Britain out of the European Union on October 31st. Johnson says he will move forward with Brexit, even if there is no deal with Brussels. The two royal heads of state would appear to have little in common. Elizabeth has been queen for 67 years. The House of Windsor has sat on the throne for hundreds of years. Philippe became king just 5 years ago after the abdication of his father, King Juan Carlos, who was restored to the throne by dictator Francisco Franco in 1969. They are blood relatives through Queen Victoria, who ruled much of the world in the 19th century. Political science professor William Ogilvy de la Vega of the Francisco Marroquín University in Madrid says that both are being asked to make political decisions because elected politicians seem unable to do their jobs. The two monarchs remain as constitutional heads of state, and as such hold what former Spanish ambassador to London, Federico Trillo Figueroa, describes as sleeping powers. Queen Elizabeth II has the power to start and end parliamentary sessions and to sign legislation into law. She exercises those powers only at the request of the Prime Minister. These powers are normally exercised in an invisible way, Trillo Figueroa tells VOA. But stepping into politics can be dangerous. Queen Elizabeth II has the power to refuse Johnson's request to end Parliament's session when they try to stop a no-deal Brexit. However, she risks angering the most traditional parts of British society. Many of them voted to leave the EU in the 2015 referendum. Buckingham Palace has already officially said that the will of Parliament should be respected. Some days ago, Brexit chief campaigner Nigel Farage released an unprecedented attack on the royal family. He called the Queen's late mother an overweight, chain-smoking gin drinker. King Philippe similarly earned the hatred of Catalan nationalists by openly supporting the federal government's direct rule on Catalonia. Barcelona mayor Ada Colau opposes Catalan independence, But she stays away from the king when he comes to Spain's second largest city. Felipe is usually greeted by protests in the Catalan capital. The newspaper El Mundo reported that former Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy advised against a royal televised speech in which Felipe accused Catalan officials of acting with disloyalty before the government formally charged them with sedition and rebellion. But Raquel Casviner Canellas of the Catalan Civic Union says the king needed to speak to pro-Spanish unionists who felt that the central government had been too cautious. Felipe's father, Juan Carlos, brought the country to democracy after the death of Franco. He later stopped a coup attempt by the military in 1981. The younger generation of royals also seems to be more interested in politics. Prince Harry's wife, Meghan Markle, Duchess of Sussex, has drawn criticism for political bias in a coming article she edited for British Vogue, titled 15 Forces for Change. Of the 15 people profiled, all are women, only 5 are white, and most represent left-wing causes, wrote London's Daily Telegraph. Britain's Daily Express, meanwhile, notes that former U.S. President Barack Obama is very close to Harry and Meghan and offers them advice. I'm Susan Shand.
A disease that threatens the world's most popular fruit, the banana, has arrived in Latin America. As a result, officials in Colombia have declared a state of emergency. Bananas are among the most important food crops in the world, along with wheat, rice, and corn. That information comes from the United Nations. 5 years ago, the UN warned that a disease called Tropical Race 4, or TR4, could destroy much of the world's banana crop. The disease first appeared in Asia in the 1990s. It later spread to Africa and the Middle East. There are as many as 1,000 kinds of bananas grown in more than 150 countries. The TR4 disease only affects the most popular and common kind of banana, the Cavendish. It is easier and more cost-effective for growers to produce just one kind of banana. Growers in Colombia and many other places choose Cavendish bananas. This variety can be shipped to countries around the world without ripening too quickly. Banana industry watchers say there is still time to find another kind of banana to grow. Not long ago, the Gros Michel, also known as Big Mike, was the world's most popular banana. Big Mike was destroyed in the 1960s by the same disease that is now threatening Cavendish. Randy Pletz is a retired scientist from the University of Florida. He studied tropical plant diseases. He said of the recent spread of TR4, I don't think it's going to impact the availability of the Cavendish in supermarkets anytime soon. He added that Asian countries affected by the TR4 disease have planted different kinds of Cavendish or moved to uninfected farmlands. But those bananas are not as productive, and they later become infected too. In Colombia, officials are taking special measures to stop the disease from spreading. Officials have removed plants infected with the disease and covered soil with black plastic sheets to prevent spread of the disease. Officials have also set up controls at entrances to affected banana farms, where they disinfect the trucks that travel between the farms and ports. The country's military and police are also guarding banana farms to keep thieves from spreading the disease through their clothes and shoes. So far, the disease has been found on 6 farms near Colombia's border with Venezuela. Officials say the affected area is still small and is not hurting the country's banana exports. Colombia's agriculture minister, Andrés Valencia, told the Associated Press, "We will continue to work towards stopping this disease from spreading to the rest of Colombia." He said growers will one day have to plant other kinds of bananas that are more disease-resistant. Gert Kema is a plant scientist who studies bananas. He agrees that the banana industry needs to diversify. He says there are many types of tomatoes and peppers grown around the world, for example. Bananas should be no different.
Researchers have created a wearable device they say can extend energy while providing assistance for walking and running. The robotic device, called an exosuit, is described in a study in the magazine Science. Researchers from Harvard University's Weiss Institute say the exosuit demonstrates great possibilities for future inventions of lightweight wearables that could have mass appeal. Many wearable assistive devices developed in the past have been designed mainly to help people with physical disabilities. The new exosuits could also help disabled people. However, they could also provide energy and speed to everyone. The device is about 5 kilograms. It was built to be simplified and non-restrictive compared to other wearable devices. The robotic shorts are made of soft, stretchy material. A computer and motor control the device, which attaches around the waist and thighs. Cables connect the motor to the user's upper leg. With each step, the system creates pressure on the cables. This gives power to the upper leg muscles. The team called its system a breakthrough in wearable technology. One reason for this is that it is very difficult to build a device to assist both walking and running. Past developments have centered on either activity, but not both. Walking and running use different hip movements, also known as a person's gait. The new exosuit uses sensors and an algorithm to help it recognize which gait is being used. The device then attempts to provide assistance with walking or running motions. The study found that a main result of this assistance is a reduction in the metabolic cost to a walker or runner. Metabolism is the process by which living things turn food into energy. A reduced metabolic rate means a person will use less energy while performing a physical activity. In tests, the exosuit reduced the metabolic rate of walking by 9.3%, the researchers said. For running, the metabolic cost dropped about 4%. Less energy was required in tests involving flat surfaces as well as on hills, the study found. Connor Walsh is a professor at the Wyss Institute. He helped lead the study. He admitted that the metabolic reductions were not huge, but he said the research presents possibilities for further development in wearable device technology. Walsh said the study demonstrates that a lightweight wearable assisting device can help pave the way for these systems to become ubiquitous in our lives. The researchers noted that the lower metabolic rates also have the effect of making a person feel lighter. The testing showed that a person walking with the device would feel 7.4 kilograms lighter. A runner would feel 5.7 kilograms lighter. The team is still doing research. No devices are currently available to the public. One of the team's major goals is to reduce the weight of the device by at least 40%. Researchers also plan to add more individualized assistance possibilities. They also hope to improve the system to fit as many uses as possible. In addition to people with disabilities, the team hopes the devices can help people at risk for work injuries, as well as those who just want to improve their physical performance. I'm Brian Lynn.
Today, on our National Parks journey, we travel to Utah. The Western state is home to several of the most popular national parks in America. Today, we travel to the eastern part of the state. We visit a park filled with strange and beautiful colored rock formations. These formations have been created over millions of years. They curve and narrow and balance on top of one another. Some are extremely thin. Others have huge cracks yet remain standing. Many of the rock formations seem to ignore the rules of gravity. Welcome to Arches National Park.
Arches are formations that look like half a circle standing up. Sometimes they create a curved bridge between two large rocks. Arches National Park contains the most natural rock arches of any place on Earth. The smallest arches are less than a meter across. The largest, called Landscape Arch, measures 93 meters from one base of the arch to the other. Water and ice, extreme temperatures, and many layers of salt underground created these rock formations over hundreds of millions of years. The huge amount of salt is the remains of an ancient sea. It covered the area around 300 million years ago. As time passed, the area filled with material left by rivers. Rocks buried the area. This created pressure on the underground salt bed.
Salt under pressure moves easily. It is not stable. The thick cover of rock created pressure on the salt. It moved this way and that, making the rock layers above move as well. A soft rock called sandstone moved upwards. It met with other harder rocks. These sandstone structures continued to grow for about 150 million years. Scientists say water is the most important element in creating arches. Water destroys the chemicals that keep rock particles together. The rock breaks as the water freezes and expands. Then the wind blows away the loose rock pieces. Erosion from wind and weather slowly removed layers of younger rock. Most of the layers of rock seen today are pinkish red in color. The rock is called Entrada sandstone. Experts say that most arches seen in the park today developed within the past million years. But the land formations continue to change slowly over time.
But sometimes change happens quickly. In 2008, a formation called Wall Arch suddenly collapsed. Thousands of tons of sandstone crashed to the ground, creating a thunderous noise. It is not easy to predict when arches might collapse. Wall Arch was not as thin as Landscape Arch, for example. Wall Arch also did not have visible cracks. But many tiny breaks within the stone made the arch weaker than others. Some formations within the park look as though the gentlest wind could send huge pieces of rock crashing to the ground. These are called balanced rocks. The most famous of all is simply called balanced rock. This sandstone rock is the size of three school buses. It sits on top of a tower of darker rock called mudstone. The formation is about 39 meters tall. This bottom rock narrows sharply where it connects to the sandstone rock on top. Scientists call this a bridge. Mudstone weathers much more quickly than sandstone. One day, far in the future, balanced rock will no longer be balanced. Just as wall arch did, balanced rock will collapse.
The names of the rock formations give you information about their appearance or structure. The most famous arch within the park is named Delicate Arch. Delicate means easily broken or damaged, but it can also mean very carefully and beautifully made. Delicate Arch is a huge freestanding arch. It is 19 meters high and 13 meters wide. Humans have called it many different names throughout history. The name Delicate Arch first appeared in a 1934 article. Scientists described it as the most delicately chiseled arch in the entire area. Of the 2,000 stone arches within the park, Delicate Arch has become a symbol of the state of Utah. It is among the most famous geological features in the world. Many of Arch's famous rock formations are easily seen from the single road that goes through the park. But Delicate Arch is not visible from a car. Some visitors choose to walk to two viewpoints. But even from the viewpoints, Delicate Arch is still more than a kilometer away. Many visitors choose to hike up to see the famous arch. The trail is 5 kilometers. It is the most popular hike in the park. The walk is difficult and steep. It offers no shade. The sun is extremely strong. In summer months, the temperature can rise to 40 degrees Celsius. Park officials tell hikers to take at least 2 liters of water with them. In winter months, ice and water can make the sandstone trail extremely slick.
Along the way, hikers pass a wall of ancient animal drawings created by the Ute Indians. These are called petroglyphs. Petroglyphs exist throughout the park. They are a reminder of the long human history in this harsh environment. Before reaching Delicate Arch, hikers must walk on a long and narrow rock ledge. The trail is often crowded with people, but most say the heat and crowds are worth it. Delicate Arch stands alone above a natural sandstone bowl. It rises up dramatically from the flat land that surrounds it. On one side of the arch, the sandstone gently twists. On the other, a severe crack cuts through the narrowing rock. Those who hike to its base appreciate and understand why it was once described as delicate. Most visitors to Arches National Park would agree that there is no other place quite like it in the world. It is quiet and dreamlike, unpredictable and violent, old yet ever-changing. A trip to Arches is like visiting another world.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.